Dear friends, we are very happy to have Dr. Ashley Tellis visiting our campus. Dr. Tellis is an alumnus of our college, St. Xavier's, Mumbai. And he's currently at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a senior fellow there. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace is one of the best think tanks in the world devoted towards cultivating harmonious relations between different countries. And Dr. Tellis has done his bit in fostering a healthy relationship between the United States and India. We are happy to have him here visiting our campus again. We wish him well, and we pray for international well-being, which is his main area of expertise and his main desirable.
Ashley, sir, thank you so much for joining us here today. We are elated to have someone with a corpus of knowledge as large and as vibrant as yours, and we're glad that we can pick your brains on DRS's theme for this year, which is rejuvenation. I've tried to center today's questions to include the various happenings in the field of geopolitics and even otherwise, and centered it around rejuvenation at the same time, which brings me to my first question. To rejuvenate means to rekindle youth, to restore vigor, to become a renewed version of oneself. Taken in that sense, what are the ingredients in rejuvenating India, be it mobilizing the youth or even becoming a greener economy? Your thoughts on these?
So I'm glad that you'll have chosen the theme of rejuvenation, because I think it's an apt theme for a country that is both old and young at the same time. There is a history to this country that goes back thousands of years. And yet, as a state, India is still relatively young in the scheme of things. So I think the challenge for India in some ways is to rediscover the sources of its vitality. Look to those sources for elements of strength that will enable it to cope with the challenges that lie ahead. And let me flag, I think, two or three tasks that India has in this journey going forward. I think the first task facing India is to rediscover the meaning of the idea of India itself. There was a vision of India in 1947, soon after independence, which was reflected in the constitution that India gave itself in 1950. Today, the idea of India as expressed in that constitution is under debate. And in some ways, it's a healthy debate, and it's a debate that should be had. But those questions have not been settled yet. They've been reopened. And I think it's very important for India's future that the polity as a whole develop a consensus about what the idea of India is. And in a generic sense, I think what would be most attractive about the idea of India that is waiting to be discovered is an India that is inclusive, that India has space for all its inhabitants, irrespective of their social standing, their religion, their economic class, their beliefs, and so on and so forth. So to my mind, I think one of the key elements is really bringing to closure productively the current debate about the idea of India, and using the consensus that is forged as a result of that debate to create a template for an India that looks forward. I think there are two other elements which come together, which are equally important. The first is to look at Indian politics and look for ways in which the political system can create structured opportunities for people to participate in the life of the country. We all know the facts on this, that there are many people who are really outside the political process. They vote every 5 years, sometimes more frequently depending on when elections are held in the states or for local government. But whether there is active political participation is still an open question. So I think that is an element that needs to be part of the process of rejuvenation, because politics is really the most obvious pathway that people have to showing how they're part of a bigger whole. And then the second, of course, is economics. India has done very well in recent times. That has not been the case historically. And I think the country faces the challenge of how it can sustain its recent economic performance in a way that is self-sustaining, that will create opportunities for the millions of people who are still poor and who still have not achieved what the ambitions of India were at the time of independence, and yet does so in a responsible way, in a way that is respectful of the environment, in a way that is respectful of the way in which various resources are utilized, and so on and so forth. So I think there's a trinity of issues that bear on rejuvenation. The first is ideational. What kind of country do we want to be? The second is political. How do we create a framework to allow people to participate in decision-making that affects their lives? And the third is economic. How does the country create opportunities for people to better their conditions and realize the ambitions that India's founding fathers had some 70-odd years ago?
Just to follow up on that, along with the political economic factors which you mentioned, do you think sustainability is also a major requirement and is a need of the hour in today's day and age?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It becomes even more important today, because when you look at the history of Western development over the last 500 years, it's a story of incredible achievement, no question about it. But it's also a history of extremely high costs that were paid to create those achievements. And those costs are now being borne essentially by a global community, because not enough attention was given to the fact that resources simply cannot be exploited because they are there. These resources have to be treated as an inheritance, an inheritance to be passed on to people yet to come. And so being able to use the world's gifts in a way that is respectful, not just of the world itself, which, you know, is an inanimate entity, but respectful for the people who are alive today and the people who are not yet alive today. So there are issues of intergenerational equity which have to be kept in mind. And so making sustainability as really a value that we always keep in our consciousness, even as we think about issues pertaining to progress, I think that moment is now.
No, I think that is very well put and honestly a very well-rounded answer. So moving on, according to you, are there any sectors in India that require revitalizing or fresh leap into efficiency?
Oh, that's a big question. And again, I would point to three different dimensions, particularly when you look at the economy, where rejuvenation sort of looms large. So if you start with the primary sector of the Indian economy, which is agriculture, the most striking thing that hits you in the face is the fact that India still has a very large section of its population involved in agriculture. And yet this is not a very productive sector, because for employing close to half of India's population, it does not produce half of India's GDP. And so the question that the country has to face is, how do you make this sector more productive so that either the individual contributions of the people working in the sector increase, or that the employment itself compresses so that these individuals who are quote-unquote surplus can then be moved to other sectors where their contributions can be more productive. So the whole challenge of making Indian agriculture productive, reducing the number of people who are involved in agricultural activities, and making India essentially the breadbasket, you know, for this part of the world, I think those are big challenges that this country faces. This takes us into a very tricky area, the whole area of agricultural reforms and institutional reforms in agriculture. Prime Minister Modi made an attempt at one point to try to do some modest reforms along these lines. But because of political opposition, he pulled back from those reforms. So that's a job half done. And yet it's an issue that has to be re-engaged. So I would say when you look at issues of efficiency, what's happening in India's primary sector is something that really deserves a second look. The second aspect has to do with, you know, what is called the secondary sector, which is Indian manufacturing. Among the fast-growing economies of the world, India is still quite striking for having a relatively small manufacturing sector. Most of the efforts of governments are focused at the sexy end of manufacturing. You know, the government wants to make integrated circuits and semiconductors and things like that, iPhones. That's all wonderful. But that kind of manufacturing does not speak to the comparative strengths of the vast mass of India's population. Most of India's manufacturing is in the small and medium scale industry sector. And that's the sector that has not received the attention that it deserves. And so if you want to rejuvenate Indian manufacturing, you can't focus simply at the high end, where employment gains are actually very modest. You know, high-end manufacturing is highly capital intensive, which means it's not going to offer opportunities for employment for people. And we all know that India's population is young, and a huge challenge is how do you productively employ them in the economy going forward. So when one thinks about the future of manufacturing in this country, one really needs to think about what one does, not at the high end, but at the middle and lower end, because that's the ticket to most young Indians entering the formal economy. And last, I would say the service sector. Everyone looks at the service sector as a great success over the last 30 odd years, and that's because of the information technology industry, the software industry, and so on and so forth. I think that's very good. That's a great achievement. But it's time now for India to transition from simply becoming the back office of the world to really providing high value added services, services that involve design, services that involve, you know, research and development, and so on and so forth. So when one looks at the broad, you know, swath of the Indian economy, there's still a lot of work to be done in each of the three sectors that constitute it. And any economic rejuvenation agenda will not have the luxury of choosing one at the expense of the other. The country has to do all three simultaneously. That's not easy, but it has to be done.
So Ashley, correct me if I'm wrong, but I was under the impression that India, along with China and Vietnam, is actually a manufacturing hub. And a lot of companies set up their manufacturing units in India. So I was under the impression that manufacturing does actually generate employment in India.
No, that's not quite right. China today still dominates global manufacturing on a scale that it has no comparisons. China today hosts about 30% of global manufacturing capacity. No other country comes close. There has been in recent times, because of the tensions in U.S.-China relations, a desire to move away from China in terms of core manufacturing. Some of that shift shift is occurring, but it's occurring mostly in regards to Southeast Asia. And Vietnam is a great example of the ability to attract manufacturing business that has moved out of China. But India is nowhere again in terms of achievement, has not demonstrated achievements even comparable to Vietnam. So there is still a long way for India to go. And it's not easy. It's not easy when you are so late in the cycle, so late in the game, to simply expect that companies will come to India and begin manufacturing. But I think this government, the government of Prime Minister Modi, has made real efforts in that regard. But I think we are still at the earliest stages of that story.
Okay, thank you so much for that answer. So is global peace a myth according to you? And is it ever achievable or should we just give up on it?
I don't think you can ever give up on global peace, right? No matter how hard it appears to achieve. The reason you can't is that if you give up on peace, then you've essentially settled for the alternative, which is not very palatable. And so we need to keep in our consciousness the ideal of peace at all times, because it serves as a metric by which we measure our own deviations from it. If you give up on the idea of peace as an ideal, you have nothing to measure your descent into failure by. And so I think it becomes extremely important that we always keep peace centrally and the objective of peace centrally in everything that we try and do. And even when sometimes we have to deviate from it and use force, engage in violence, the fact that we have the yardstick of peace by which we measure our actions imposes actually limits on the kind of violence that we can engage in. So I do not think it's an option. We cannot simply jettison the idea of peace and think that life will remain comfortably the same after that.
So far, we've discussed the hard disciplines, economics and politics, things that spark the most heat at dinner table conversations or even newsrooms. Coming to a more softer discipline, in our deliberations on rejuvenation, culture often plays a key role. How important do you think it is for a country to have a shared cultural identity? Certain countries abroad have started to lose their culture or have started to see subcultures or several multiple subdivisions of cultures into a multitude of differing groups. What is your take on this?
So I think there are issues of fact and there are issues of how facts are to be understood. So let's start with the simple fact. Every country has a culture. There's no question about that, to the degree that there are intellectual worldviews, to the degree that there are symbolic artifacts that people relate to the degree that there is some shared or sometimes a not shared sense of history, to the degree that there are authoritative texts, whether they be religious texts or cultural texts or historical texts. All these are elements of culture. And those elements are found in almost every society you can imagine. So in that sense, culture is a fact. But the question I think that you are putting your finger on is how are those facts to be understood? And whether those facts are meant to be so uniform that they bind all the inhabitants of a country together. I think that is a harder that is a harder challenge, because to me, the biggest challenge that most large countries face today is creating enough room for people with different worldviews to still constructively engage one another. And so, does one think of culture as being a set of symbolic resources that divide people within a country? Or is the culture, which is the set of symbolic resources, permeable enough to allow people with different worldviews to still find common purpose in what they are about? I think countries that think of culture as being monotheistic, and or at least monistic, it's not monotheistic, but monistic, and by definition, then include and exclude, I think that is a somewhat impoverished vision of culture. But if you think of culture as being pluriform, that has room for different kinds of representations, particularly in complex societies, you know, like India and the United States, I think that's the only way forward. So again, this becomes part of that national consensus which has to be evolved on what matters at the symbolic levels for the people in a country. India is going through this debate. The United States is going through this debate. We see this debate taking place in different countries in Western Europe today in new ways. The end of the story has not yet been written, but there are enough disturbing trends that one needs to be alert and wakeful about.
I completely agree that culture should at the very least be an efficient, powerful tool for us to tackle the global challenges as a country, as a whole, one that is a unifying factor as opposed to a divisive one. One of the ways in which culture manifests itself in a country is its ancient sites and cultural heritage sites. As of May 2023, for example, in India, a total of 45 projects covering pilgrimage sites across the country have been approved for restoration under the Prasad scheme. This is just one of the several examples of restoration, a way in which we can win back the lost secrets of our cultures. Considering this, how should India balance the preservation of cultural heritage with the increasing requirement to modernize its infrastructure?
I don't see any tension between the two. I mean, the tension may be at an empirical level, that is, the resources you apply to cultural conservation, by definition, are resources not available for other things. But I think that is a trivial tension that can be very easily managed. To me, the bigger question is this. There is a compelling argument to be made for preserving all the symbolic sites that are of historic significance. But the point to keep in mind, I think, is India's diversity. And different social groups in India have different historic sites which they think as uniquely symbolically powerful for themselves. And so an agenda of cultural conservation must be Catholic enough with a small c to encompass the preservation of all symbolic sites that matter to the diversities that are present in India. So as long as that remains the yardstick by which cultural conservation is approached, I think it would be a great investment to preserve cultural artifacts that are historically significant. I mean, I also think of it in a different way, going back to the question that I had identified earlier, the theme I talked about earlier of intergenerational equity, right? You want to preserve these artifacts precisely because they are artifacts from India's past. They provide an enormous source of satisfaction because of what they represent. And you want to preserve them for the generations that have yet to come. So it's really the continuity that these artifacts manifest when you think about this country, not at this moment in time, but over the whole span of time. And so, you know, a country that forgets its history, that is oblivious to its diversity, that fails to appreciate that at the end of the day, India is really a remarkable social experiment of trying to, you know, discover and preserve the elements of unity in a very complex diversity. If your cultural conservation captures these elements, I think every paise spent on those efforts would be worthwhile.
Thank you for that very new, refreshing perspective. So lastly, to end on sort of a peaceful note, what according to you is the ideal world order, the way in which the world is structured to ensure peace, security, and financial safety for all?
That's a question that's almost impossible to answer. But I think the most peaceful world order is one that creates room for different countries to express their own ambitions without the use of violence. We have to work towards creating an international system where the legitimate interests of all of the constituent parts can be expressed without stepping on the toes of other constituent parts. And in some ways, you know, that has been a project that has consumed human beings since the beginning of time. And we really haven't done very well at it, as you can tell. So I expect that this is a struggle that we will just simply be, you know, consumed by till the end of our days. I mean, it's the tragedy of the human condition that, you know, some solutions will never be found within history. World peace is one of those. As long as human beings are human beings, I do not expect that we will one day suddenly construct a political paradise, right? But that doesn't mean that we should not keep the vision of a tranquil political community always before our eyes. Because as I said earlier, if you lose sight of that ideal, then you have nothing by which to measure any deviations from that ideal. And then everything goes. And so even when the struggle for peace becomes hardest to achieve, it's worth reminding ourselves about what peace actually means.
I just want to ask how this vision for a peaceful world, how do you think, like, what can we do to implement that? And what measures can we take to make that vision a reality?
So I think as a very practical measure, I think we need to look at multilateral institutions and the degree to which they can be reformed. I mean, it's obviously a very complicated question with so many dimensions to it. And there's no single point answer. You know, you can't simply say, what is it that we need to do to bring about world peace? There are a million things, some of which I can think of and others that completely escape me. But if you think of small steps that would help in that direction, one thing that would come to mind is the character of the organizations in the international system. Are those organizations sufficiently representative so that everyone has a voice? That would be one set of things to pay attention to. The second might be the rules of behavior in the international system are the rules that we currently uphold adequate to the objective of the preservation of peace or the putting burdens on those who would seek to violate them through force or the use of violence. So I think there are small things that have to be done towards that great goal of peace. And focusing on the institutional dimensions, and I would say the dimension of the rules, you know, would be small and simultaneously big steps towards that end.
Thank you so much.
Well, with that, we come to an end to this enriching podcast. Thank you so much, Ashley, sir, for your tremendous insights. We've discussed geopolitics and rejuvenation at length today, and I hope our listeners have gained fresh perspectives on their worldview today. I extend my heartfelt gratitude to Dr. Father Keith for making this conversation possible. And sir, we hope to see you soon.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to come back to St. Xavier's.